Well, good to be here again and to look at a portion of the Word of God and look at this particular subject this morning. And this time we were able to find the place, and I think being here for the quiz rally helped a bit. So after several trips now, we haven't quite got the time down yet. We're getting close, but at least we know the right general direction here. We should be getting both on mine and yours. We had it a minute ago. Okay, I'll go ahead while she's doing that. On the subject of we're looking at the minor prophets as an overview, and then we're looking also particularly at the book of Haggai. And we just finished a study at Overbrook. I just finished one there on the how our scriptures and the idea of the manuscripts and all of this. It's fairly intense time that we're looking at some of the manuscript issues. And I told my wife, I said, I think what I'm going to do when I get there is to say simply, you know, to really understand the Old Testament prophets, to understand the minor prophets, we have to understand how it got here. So I think we'll spend the morning talking about manuscripts. No, we're going to go ahead and talk about the minor prophets. Very interestingly, as I was doing some reading on this, James Montgomery Boyce talks about when he started to study the minor prophets, and he said, I was kind of in between some major studies, and I thought I would go to the minor prophets because the books were short and would allow me an opportunity. I could get some messages out of this and in a short period of time. 10 years later, he completed his study of the minor prophets. He said it turned out to be one of the most fruitful studies that he had done, and of course took him considerably longer than he had ever anticipated. Well, I have not been studying this for 10 years, so we are going to try to look at it, though, and get something from the minor prophets. I have greatly enjoyed this time of looking at it. It's one of those studies that for many years I had thought this is something I would like to do, would be to get into the minor prophets. Now, we did it at the Sunday school, the men's Sunday school class a number of years ago at Overbrook, and that continued to whet my appetite to go back into the minor prophets. And so my appetite is still there. It has not been satiated at all. Just from what I have done for this has significantly increased that appetite, and I hope that's what this will do for you, is to give you an appetite to go in, to study, to see what all is there in the minor prophets. Too many times, I think, we totally neglect that area of study. And in fact, just look at Isaiah, Jeremiah, sometimes a little bit of Ezekiel and Daniel, and we just really don't get to the others at all, except for a few verses. And there are some key verses that are, of course, very appropriate right now in Micah 5:2, and we pull that one out, and we pull out a few others. But other than that, we really don't get into the riches that are there. And I was saying it was a rather poor pun, the whole thing, on the minor prophets, and you know, what kind of miners were they, whether they were gold miners or coal miners. And I thought, well, you know, in one sense, they were kind of both. I got rich from the gold that's there, and I got warm. My heart was warmed as I looked and the heat that came out of it. So we're going to look at this. Let's look, first of all, at let's get an overview here. Okay. On the value of prophecy. A window that God has opened for His people by His servants, the prophets. Through it, one can see more of God's purpose in His redemptive work than would be possible otherwise. He gives a better understanding of what He had done for and with and through His people in the past, and a clearer comprehension of His purpose in the present. And while it may never satisfy insatiable demands for specific details of the future, it nevertheless gives a clear view of where God's grace is taking humanity and what obligations, therefore, are laid upon His people. We want to look at some definitions. And again, I'm starting very broadly and just looking at the idea of prophecy as a whole. And then from there, we'll move on in specifically into the minor prophets. And then specifically from there, we will go to Haggai. And one of the things Sam told me to do was to start this, and I didn't start it. And stop here. All right. There we go. So I'm about what? I need to start it. You got it back there, Sam? Okay, good. I'm glad somebody's doing this. Definition for a prophet. And the Hebrew word there, nabi, and a good deal of discussion over where what the root is for that word in various language origins. And some argue that it is to proclaim or to announce. I like the other one that some found. To flow, to boil up, to bubble over. And idea of to pour forth words. And another, the focus being called, one who is called, and specifically one who is called by God. Old Testament usage, however, that's looking at it from the root word and trying to go back to its origins. And there's a good deal of debate in the various languages as to where it actually came from. And if you go beyond that, however, the best way of defining it is to go into the Old Testament and look at actual Old Testament usage and the context that is there. And in the Old Testament usage, the one who speaks for God in Exodus chapter 7, verses 1 and 2, and Exodus 4:16. Someone, let's see, John or Ed, one of you have that there, and I'll have different ones of you reading some passages as we go along here. We got.
And the Lord said unto Moses, "See, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet. Thou shalt speak all that I command thee, and Aaron thy brother shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land."
Okay. So here, Aaron was in essence the prophet for Moses. He was Moses' mouthpiece, the one who was speaking for him unto Pharaoh. So giving the idea of one who speaks for another. And then Exodus 4:16, Ed?
"And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be to thee instead of a man, and thou shalt be to him instead of God."
Okay.
"Or as God."
Okay. As one who speaks, again, for God. So definition there, really, a speaker or mouthpiece for God is our definition for prophet. And Septuagint gives us a better definition there, and with the Greek word prophetes, to speak for another. And very clear in the New Testament, or in the Septuagint rather, when the Greek is translating the Old Testament word for prophet. Then additional Old Testament support, we won't look at all of those. But in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 7, it is to speak what God commands. In Jeremiah 15:19, one who would be as God's mouth. Isaiah 1:20, his words were from the mouth of God. And then Jeremiah 23:16, the important distinction here for false prophets was that they spoke not out of the mouth of God. So they were speaking their own words rather than the words which God directed them to speak. There are two additional Hebrew words that are translated and are used as synonymous with prophet. And the words meaning to see and are translated as seer. And they are synonymous with the Hebrew word for nabi. And a good place showing that is 1 Samuel 9:9 and Amos 7:12. Someone want to read from 1 Samuel 9:9?
"Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, 'Come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet is formerly called a seer.'"
Okay. Yeah. So both, so the term there, seer and prophet, used interchangeably. So just one example of that. Another is found over in Amos. Some other terms that are used for them, frequently the man of God, and the emphasis coming from that is upon the holy calling, the moral character, the divine ministry that is there, and Deuteronomy 33 and also 1 Samuel chapter 9. And servant of the Lord, and here stressing the close holy relationship between God and his messengers, Second Kings, and then also Messenger of the Lord. I think that's an interesting one. Get it here a second up here. The Messenger of the Lord, same term that is used for angels. And it's a messenger of His revealed word. So the same term that is used for angels there is the Messenger of the Lord applies also to the prophet. So in the same sense that the angel was one who was a messenger from the Lord, in the same sense was an Old Testament prophet. Then we come to the functions. And with the functions, the prophetic function essentially was a twofold function. First of all, was the idea of forthtelling. They were the divinely appointed moral and ethical preachers and teachers of true religion as it was revealed to Israel. And the next, I think, is very strong statement that is here. To their contemporaries, they were the moral and ethical preachers of spiritual religion, calling the nation to obedience in conformity to the Mosaic legislation. Fearlessly rebuked vice, idolatry, infidelity, oppression, unfaithfulness, iniquity, and social, moral, and political corruption wherever it was to be found. It was their calling to show the people their transgression. And I think that really can be underscored is the fact of their calling, pointing up to the people the transgression, their sin, and you see all the other characteristics there. And as you read through, and particularly in these minor prophets, that's something that really comes across strongly if you've got a sense of the overall, is this judgment and the sin and the iniquity of the people. And of course, you're going to see it in different periods that's stronger than others. But as you take it as a whole, there's a very strong emphasis on that. But not only did they foretell, which is in the sense we think of as the New Testament prophet, and that's the dimension that comes to us today as a forthtelling, as spokesman for God and telling forth His message. But there is also that which is foretelling. And foretelling the message, that would be the predictions of the future events concerning the nation of Israel, the Gentiles, and the Messianic age which is to come. And again, we find a good deal of Messianic prophecies in the minor prophets. The predictive prophecy was concerned with judgment, salvation, the Messiah, and His kingdom. There were four prophetic points, and that it's important to distinguish with the prophets and when they're making the foretelling. Many times with the prophet here, and he would be speaking about immediate time, the prophet's own time, Israel and Judah. Then another occasion would be the near future, having to do with the captivity and the restoration after the time of coming back from the Babylonian captivity. Or their predictions had to do with the time of Christ, and which again obviously was more distant. Or finally, the last of these, the judgments, millennium, new heavens, new earth, and particularly the period of millennium. And also judgment in terms of the day of the Lord. We'll find that phrase used a good bit. So these four time periods occur in terms of their telling of the future. And so it's important to distinguish, and sometimes with the prophecy, there was a double reference. And so they would be referring to something that was in the near future, but also had a time of fulfillment either at the time of the first coming of Christ or is still to be fulfilled in terms of the ultimate judgments or the millennial kingdom. Then we look at some various classifications for prophets. And how do we classify them? Well, we can classify into the writing and the non-writing prophets. And the ones we're most familiar with, of course, are the writing prophets. Well, I don't know the most familiar, because you think of Elijah and Elisha. they were not writing prophets. But if I start asking if prophets had come to mind, Elijah comes to mind very quickly, very popular one. But there were a lot of others who were not as popular as Elijah or Elisha, who also didn't write. And so you start running a list. We'd run on for several pages. Most of the books that I read on this would list these out, and you've got several pages of prophets there that were non-writing prophets. So if you wanted something fun to do, go through the Scripture and start jotting down all the ones that were not writing. On the other hand, we have the writing prophets, and those are the ones we're most familiar with, and we're going to identify all of those as we go along. So that's the first category for breaking it down. Then we have the major or the minor prophets. And we ask, you know, what is it we call the minor prophets? Why do we make that distinction, and what is the basis for the distinction? Well, interestingly, the distinction is based strictly on length of the book. And in fact, it wasn't made until about the 4th century A.D., during the time of Augustine. And so it was there that they decided to make that separation and refer to one as a major prophet because of the length, and the other as to a minor prophet. Prior to that time, in the Hebrew Bible, the minor prophets were all put together in a single scroll and generally referred to just as the 12. So there was no distinction as far as major or minor. Then we can also break it down in terms of these prophets as to who were the recipients here, who is receiving the message. Israel, and particularly there, Hosea and Amos would be the two prophets whose message is directed to the nation of Israel as such. To Judah, and eight of them here, Joel, Isaiah, Micah, Zephaniah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Again, except for your two major prophets there, Isaiah and Jeremiah, and the others being in the category of minor prophets. So most of them, again, prophesying to Judah. Prophet to Nineveh, two of them. When we mention Nineveh, most people then would think of Jonah and Jonah going to Nineveh. But Nahum also specifically prophesied to Nineveh after the time of Jonah. So a second prophecy there to them. Babylon is the recipient primarily there. Though his message is far beyond that, but it's in Babylon where Daniel is prophesying. Ezekiel, the exiles. And then Obadiah. Kind of interesting here to Edom. And, of course, Edom, the descendants of Esau, and that there's a whole book that is essentially directed to Edom in prophecy about it. Again, we get other aspects from it, but the whole force of that is directed against that one nation and that one group of people. So, then we have the chronological periods. And very easy to break down with this. The pre-exilic, and then those who prophesied during the exile, and then those who prophesied after the exile, those in the return. And again, you've got two that are prophesying during the exile, Daniel, Ezekiel, and then during the post period, only three prophets there, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. What Gentile powers were in rule during the time of the different prophets? Assyria, and you can see the list there of the different ones. Babylon and Persia. So again, three dominant world powers during the times of the different prophets. And of course, these prophets influenced by those world powers. The dates, and I'll just run these through quickly. You've got them all listed there. I'm not going to go over each one of these, but just so you can see to get a sense of it. And notice the earliest is Obadiah, in about 845. And with the dates, we're looking at a lot of what we call windows here and approximations. And when we go specifically through these on the minor ones, I'll mention what the kind of the latitude is for it. This is just rather an arbitrary picking of a date. The few that we can pretty well nail down, and that happens to be one of the ones we're looking at this time, Haggai. Haggai is very specific, and he nails it down. We can put it to the day. And so a couple of them, we can do that. But others, a lot of questions are in there, just simply because you're not sure when this event, whether they make reference to an event, or they're referring to this time or this time. So you make your best guess. And in fact, even with Obadiah and Joel, there we look at those as being the two earliest prophets. But on the other hand, there are those who would put them into the post-exile period and say that they're much, much, much later period of time. So generally, the thought is they are the two earliest of the prophets. But as I say, on the minor prophets, we will look specifically at those days. The impact of the minor prophets. And let me just say just a qualification here. I'm quoting specifically James Montgomery Boyce. And I just would like to, whenever I quote or cite somebody else, I'd like to just say a word there. Boyce is good on a lot of things, but you've got to be careful with Boyce. Okay, Boyce has very strong Calvinistic leanings and some other areas as well. But he does have some very good exposition and inspirational material. And I glean a lot from him, but I'm also very careful and I skip over a lot as well. So I just pass that along because sometimes people will say, well, they quoted this person, must be good, and everybody goes to them and starts reading and you get things that you wouldn't necessarily agree with. So just be aware of the fact that there are many strengths with him, but there are also some weaknesses there. One of the things I was surprised at when I was very leery of looking at Boyce on the minor prophets, so I've gotten a good deal out of him on other sections that I've studied. And I thought on minor prophets, he's going to really be off with his eschatology because I know he's coming from a Reformed perspective and all of this. And I thought, and he surprised me because he said, I part company with the rest of my Reformed brethren here on some eschatological views because it's so clear in the Old Testament about the millennial kingdom and the regathering of Israel and all of this. He says, I part company from, and I just was shocked when I read that. Oh, wow, okay. He's a lot smarter than I thought he was. I mean, I always thought he was smart, but he's even smarter than that. So he's great. So, as I say, he has some good things to say, and I'm going to read the section when we get to Haggai. He has a great little section in there, and he's quoting, actually, from Ironside. And a very nice section. But on this, they dramatize the character of God as few other books do. And I love this. Of course, you would not be surprised at all to find his first statement there, that they highlight the sovereignty of God. Of course, that's what Boyce is going to say, but it's true. And the minor prophets do indeed do that. They highlight God's sovereignty, and I love the way he expresses it. Indeed, they do more than merely highlight it. They breathe it throughout. And the point that he is making is that what you see in this is not only God working in the nation of Israel and working in Judah, working among his people, but you see God's hand all throughout these other kingdoms. And you see what God is doing to them and doing to them and how he's working all of that together for his purposes and how he's going to bring all of that together. So he is working all things to his glory. And that's what Boyce is really emphasizing here, is that you see every dimension aspect of God's sovereignty in the affairs of men. But awareness also of the holiness of God, the driving force behind the sharp denunciation of sin, that these prophets were keenly aware of the holiness of God and the sinfulness of the people. And then the third one is one that is overlooked often, the prophets speaking of God's love. And that it is God's love that causes the prophets to so speak against the sinfulness and for God to bring his judgment upon them because of his love for the people. So he judges and to try to move them away from the sin which is so destructive to them as a people and as a nation, and all of that motivated by God's love and concern for His people. So, three major areas that Boyce mentions here that come through: the sovereignty of God, the holiness of God, and the love of God that you find as you read the minor prophets. Now, the way we're going to be approaching this and breaking it down is looking at three groups of minor prophets. You have it on there as a, on your sheet as another classification, I think, is the way it's on there to you. Oh, okay, yes. It's on. I think it's under location on your sheet. And here I put it up on a different way on this one. But the prophets of Israel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, the prophets of Judah, and the prophets of the restored nation. So when we go through and look, this is the way it's organized, looking individually at these, we're not looking at them chronologically as they occur, or even looking at them as they occur in the Bible, but we're looking at them as they are clustered in terms of to whom are they prophesying. And so we have the prophets of Israel, the prophets of Judah, and the prophets of the restored nation. I have put the prophets of Judah first, and we'll look at those, then the prophets of Israel, and then finally the prophets of the restored nation, Zechariah, Malachi, and Haggai. Okay. First of all, the prophets of Judah. And just to, here's a graph that's up here that you don't have on yours, on your sheets. And can you, okay. Try to give you some idea again of when the prophet was there and when who was king during that particular time. So here we have the two. This is, by the way, from McDonald's commentary in the Old Testament, if you happen to have that. Taken from it. He has a nice chart, so you can refer to that. You've got it. He has one little mistake on there, and I didn't think I'd find a mistake in McDonald's commentary, but we were putting this together, and I looked, and I said, where's Obadiah? And I was looking down the whole list of all the names that he had under there. Couldn't find Obadiah. And so we said, well, did he leave out a prophet? We counted up the numbers that were there. The right number was there, but Obadiah wasn't there. You know, kept looking at it. And finally, realized this character right here had the wrong name. And he had him labeled as Rehoboam. So when you look at that in McDonald's commentary, you want to mark through Rehoboam and write Obadiah, because that's where Obadiah belongs. And that's who he's talking about there. He just got, somehow, the printers made a typo in the commentary and just plugged in the wrong name. So, to note, Joel and Obadiah are contemporaries here. And Jehoshaphat, Ahaziah, Joash, Jehoash here during this particular period. We come on down to Micah and Isaiah. And here we've got Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh. We come on down toward getting closer to the time of the Babylonian captivity. And here we have Zephaniah, Nahum, and then Habakkuk, again prophesying just prior to that time. And Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, during the time of the 70-year captivity. then we come on down. The captivity is ended by Cyrus right here. And then here we have Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai is the first of those to prophesy. And then Zechariah follows just by a few months, really, Haggai's prophesying to the exiles. Those who were returned, the returned exiles. And then Malachi, who prophesies later, is appropriately the last one in our Bible and the last one to prophesy. And so you get this period of time in here. A lot of prophetic activity taking place here toward the end of the Old Testament times. And so these writing prophets, if you look at this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, that are taking place either toward the end of the time of Judah just before going into captivity, or during captivity, or after the return. So, an enormous amount of prophetic activity that is going on in that time frame. With Obadiah, name simply means the servant of the Lord or worshiper of the Lord. His date, as I say, is uncertain. And it depends on which plundering of Jerusalem is mentioned. If you want to find Obadiah, someone want to find Obadiah and read chapter 1 there. You got it there, Andy. Okay.
In the days that he stood on the other side, in the days that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered the gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, even you were as one of them. But you should not engage in the day of your brother, in the day of his captivity, nor should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. You should not have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Indeed, you should not have gazed on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. You should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who escaped, nor should you have delivered up those among them who remained in the day of distress.
Okay. Keep it there, because we'll read verse 15 in just a second as well. Okay, so the issue there, obviously, this is when Jerusalem is being plundered. The question is, there are a couple of different possibilities. It's a very early date, and then also a late date. So is he talking about the time Nebuchadnezzar? Is he talking about an earlier time? Most believe that it is the earliest period. That would put Obadiah in about the 840 time period. But there are some other scholars, I'd say the majority of scholars put it in the earliest period. But there are others who are very good, some solid people, who say absolutely no, that it's in the later time, and he belongs much more after Nebuchadnezzar. So, uncertain. There's no way to absolutely nail it down. But again, the best judgment at this point, the highest probability, is that he was the earliest of the prophets, of the writing prophets. Theme for Obadiah, as we've already gotten a flavor of that, the judgment of Edom, again, primarily for their treatment of Israel at this point when Jerusalem is attacked. And because they rendered no aid and no assistance to them, consequently then the judgment that comes upon them. And the principle that comes out of that, as Edom sowed, so shall they reap. You got verse 15 there, Andy?
For the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head.
Okay. Pretty clear there, isn't it? And ties in good New Testament principle that whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. Now, sometimes we don't always see that carried out in immediate circumstances here. And in fact, in some of the minor prophets, this question comes up in terms of God's justice. And the Jews question, is God really being just? Because we seem to be suffering. God's judgment seems to be harsh against us. And the secular, ungodly nations out here are the ones who seem to be prospering. But ultimately, in God's ultimate calendar, all of that is going, God's debts and his justice will become apparent. So here, very clear statement that ties in, coming back to the New Testament, as a man sows, also so is he going to reap. And we certainly, this is the theme that is given to them. The promises to Israel, on the other side of this, Obadiah, he gives the judgment that is going to come to Edom, but at the same time there is a positive aspect that is going to take place with Jerusalem and the Jews and Israel, and these promises will be fulfilled. Joel, Jehovah is God. And they probably during the reign of Joash, around 820, again, some put it after 586, the second, the time of Nebuchadnezzar's attack, the fall of Jerusalem. The emphasis is going to be judgment upon Judah because of their sin. An exhortation, well, you're going to find that as a repeated emphasis. Both of those, judgment because of sin, an exhortation to turn to the Lord. Times haven't changed, have they? Same emphasis, same thing that's important for us, and we're going to... World's history will culminate in the events of the day of the Lord when the scales of justice will finally rest. And that becomes an important idea here, those scales of justice. That justice will be done because they doubted of God's justice because of His judgment that was being pronounced against them. And of course, it comes out clearly here with a key phrase, on the day of the Lord. And Joel underscores that day of the Lord and the judgment five times, five references in this short book to the day of the Lord. One of the literary gems of the Old Testament, and I love the way this is expressed, the strength of Micah, the tenderness of Jeremiah, the vividness of Nahum, and the sublimity of Isaiah. Wow. What a way of expressing it. I just love it. Strength of Micah, tenderness of Jeremiah, vividness of Nahum, and the sublimity of Isaiah. You know, if you haven't read these minor prophets, and I'm sure at some point, you know, as you read through the Bible all the time, but just go back and just enjoy reading them again. That's what I, in addition to trying to study this and read the other writers on them and so forth, one of the things I've been doing for several months is just reading through. Get through, come back, start again, read through, take a different translation, read through it again. And it's just been an interesting and good experience. And just going through and reading through those prophets and getting a sense of the flow and the overall impact of what is there as you read it. And it really does give the motivation to want to get below the surface in all of them. And that's all we're doing on this overview. By the way, this is overview that we're looking at. We're going to look at Haggai in a little more depth. But this is just key concepts in the minor prophets to begin with. How are we doing, Sam? What? I told you, I gave it to you because I didn't start it on time. No kidding.
I meant to try to push the button and be okay with it. So don't worry about it. Take about another 5 minutes and we'll make it right.
Okay, that seems... I did start it. See, it's not right. Okay. Micah. Oh, Micah. Micah's one of my favorites. I love Micah. You know, and if you're not enjoying Micah, go and read Micah about a dozen times, and you will. Oh, Micah's wonderful. The name means, who is like unto Jehovah? And if that doesn't send you away with just joy in your heart, just to meditate upon that. Just meditating upon the name of Micah himself. Who is like unto Jehovah? And that becomes a major theme throughout. Date between 732 and 722. We're not sure. It's after the Assyrian conquest of Damascus and before the fall of Samaria. So somewhere in between, that's where we would bracket it, and good probability. He is a contemporary of Isaiah. Okay. The theme of Micah, God will judge Judah, which is an ongoing theme, as we've mentioned, of all of these minor prophets. But pardon, this is the wonderful part. Pardon is still available. Okay, I want to come on down here. Let's look at the fulfilled prophecies that are here. Six of them, very specific prophecies that we can identify. The fall of Samaria. The invasion of Judah by Sennacherib. The fall of Jerusalem, the exile in Babylon, the return from captivity, and the birth of Christ. All of those six very clear, definitive prophecies that are made by Micah, and all of which have been very specifically and clearly fulfilled. So we can look at those from a historical perspective of looking back and seeing this was a prophecy that, you know, people want to challenge this, or are they fulfilled, whatever, etc. And we can look back and say, all right, here was a prophecy made ahead of time, here's its fulfillment, here's another one, fulfillment, here's another one, fulfillment. And so Micah, just at least six of these right here, clearly identified, that were given and have been fulfilled. Okay. Key portions, chapters 6 and 7, God's controversy with His people. Micah really captures this idea of the problems of man's relationship with God. And it's not just with the Old Testament nation that is there. It's the problem that we have today. It's the continuing problem of sin getting in the way of the relationship with God. And it just is so vivid in Micah. And the only hope for man in a relationship with God is God's pardon. You know, how tremendous. God's pardon, that's all our hope. And that's the hope that is offered to the nation at this time. Let's look at the key verses that are there. 6:8 and then 7:18 and 20. Who's got that? Okay, Larry.
6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God.
Okay. Let's just stop just a second there. Isn't that what a tremendous verse that is. That's again, what I take some of these that are very familiar verses. I hope that's a familiar verse to you. In fact, that's one I gave to my wife when she was working as purchasing agent and a company, and so she put it on their wall in her office. And I just thought, oh, it's a pretty good verse for that, you know. In fact, I've given it to a couple of lawyer friends from my students who graduated and went into law, and had a framed copy of that I gave to them, you know, to hang on their walls. And so it's a good, some good, tremendous principles that are there. Okay, Larry, then the others. 7:18-20. Go back. Read that first verse there again, if you don't mind.
Who is a God like this, yeah, who pardons iniquity and passes over the rebellious acts of the remnant of his possession? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights with unchanging love.
Isn't that tremendous? That's great. And there is Micah playing off of his name. And using that, who is a God like unto thee? Who is a God like Jehovah? And that's where he pulls that in that part of the end of that the book. What, you know, you have the judgment that he talks about earlier, but when you come to the end of it, oh, what tremendous hope is there? And he goes on at the whole end of that, of going back, he's not going to forget the promises that he made to our fathers. Those promises are there. God has to deal in judgment, but in the midst of judgment is His delight in His love and His pardon that is available, and all the promises that He made to Abraham and to Isaac and to all of the nation. So, very positive note. That's a good place to stop here. All right? I think it's about that time, according to my chronicle.